Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders Fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. Students and teachers all. Yes, we all are students and teachers, ladies and gentlemen. Those of you listening now, whether or not you're professionally engaged in either activity, you are teachers for everyone you meet. And you are lifelong students because there's always something new to learn. Our topic tonight is value in education. How should we measure it? In our society, we tend to attach a dollar sign value to just about everything we have or do. We think of our professions as what they are worth in salary or benefits. We think of our personal property as what it costs us to purchase it, what it costs us to maintain it, what its tax value is, what its property value is, if we're planning on buying or selling something. Everything that we have around us very often has a little price tag attached to it, at least in our mind. We even consider, in a kind of way, our spiritual experience and our political lives as costing us money, especially in Protestant churches where the congregation hires and fires the minister. If you feel you don't get your money's worth from a particular preacher, either he's not very good at interpreting scripture in a way that agrees with yours, or he is not sound in his doctrine, or he has a different dogma from you, you can, in effect, not renew his contract. In our educational system, we often do the same thing. We look at the amount of our tax money that goes to pay teachers and build new schools and pay the electric bills for schools and buy new equipment and so on and so forth. And we say, all right, I expect to get X amount of something or other to equal the X amount of dollars that I pay in personal property taxes, federal income tax, state income tax, and every other kind of tax that the almighty machine of government figures out to another way to put on top of us. This is not necessarily a bad way to look at things. We live in a quasi-free market economy, at least that's the way it was supposed to be, as our founders designed it, where every individual had not only the right, but the duty to make his or her own way in society by the sweat of his brow and the use of his brain. But there is so much about education that doesn't come under a nice, neat price list like a menu in a restaurant, or a list of services you can purchase from your phone company or your television provider, or even the various things you can have done to your car at the service station or at the dealership. There are so many things that an education gives us that we can't easily put a dollar sign on. And quite often, we don't realize even the dollar value of our education until long after we have finished it at whatever level we decide to stop or circumstances force us to. It is not a bad thing to wish to receive value for value expended. If I'm purchasing a new automobile, I expect it to run reliably to get me from point A to point B without either breaking down, falling apart, or consuming so much gasoline that I have to sell my house in order to fill the tank. I do expect value for my expenditure. I want that vehicle to do a particular job. And when I purchase it, my list of needs for value for my money are pretty clear. It's the same thing when we purchase a house, or we go to a doctor, or even when we go to our church and put money in the collection plate, or become a member and pay our yearly tithe, or whatever. We are expecting something in return for the money, the object of value, that we have given to the person or persons who are providing us with this object or service. We expect a certain degree of value from our public education system, which is not a bad thing. It makes excellent sense, particularly in the private sector. If you're sending your children to a private school that promises to prepare them for a college education by stringent academic standards and the best teachers and the most efficacious help if they're having difficulty, you expect them to do what they promised to do in exchange for the fees you pay them to educate your child. And if you find that they are not doing what you paid them to do, or they are not giving your child what you have paid them to give, then you are perfectly free to withdraw your child from this institution and find another one that perhaps will fulfill his or her and your needs better for the dollar amount you have to spend. If our public school system were a private school system, we would have that option. But we do not. Because our public school system we pay for, but we pay for it non-visibly and in most cases fairly painlessly. We don't necessarily write a check to the county or city or township or state every month for tuition for our children. Perhaps if we did, we might be a little more concerned with the product that we're paying for. But still, even if we could do that, even if we could eliminate the Federal Department of Education, please, dear God, answer my prayer, and make our education system a private enterprise, we would still be purchasing something that we cannot completely measure. If I buy a dress, ladies and gentlemen, that is two sizes too small for me, and I know that it's two sizes too small, do I have the right to take it back to the store and complain that it was the store's fault that I purchased something in a size 3 when I wear a size 8 or whatever? Of course I don't. I knew what my size was. I should have tried the thing on to find out whether it fit before I bought it, even if I thought I'd all of a sudden miraculously lost 150 pounds overnight. And there are people out there who think they have. Believe me, I've met a few. But I would have no right to punish the store and return goods that they sold me in good faith because my understanding of whether or not that object would fit me was inferior. It wasn't their fault that I was stupid. It was mine. And yet, we do this with our children every single day. Even when we send them to a fancy, expensive private school, we still somehow or other expect an educational institution to put a brain that functions in their head, whether they walk in the door with one or not. That's one of those intangibles that we are supposedly paying for that we really can't have. Another one of the intangibles that we believe we're paying for and that we should be able to see right away is we all have a presumption of a mental picture of what an educated person is. For some, an educated person is someone who knows a lot of things about a lot of different subjects, or who knows a great deal about one specific subject. An aeronautical engineer, perhaps, or a specialist in heart surgery, or a lawyer who knows everything there is to know about contract law, or an architect who designs and builds magnificent buildings that are beautiful and functional and incredibly safe. Or just someone who knows a little bit about, lots of different things. The so-called jack of all trades and master of none. But that's the kind of person that you want, in a business, who can be your front man and talk to people from all different walks of life about lots of different things, because he or she has interests that are very broad and knowledge enough at least to ask an intelligent question. Another personal view of an educated person might be someone who is articulate and can express him or herself clearly with the appropriate word choice that delivers meaning without flowery extra verbiage. That might be your view of an educated person. Someone else's view might be a person who can handle themselves in all the day-to-day minutiae of life. Understanding enough mathematics to correctly keep a checkbook, understand a financial contract, recognize whether interest is being exorbitantly charged, be able to figure out the measurements needed to buy carpet for the living room, be able to adapt a recipe that serves four to serve eight, or one that serves eight to serve six. This may be your view of an educated person. This intangible, this educated person viewpoint is what we believe we are purchasing with our tax money from our public schools. And yet, we're sort of like purchasing identical dresses that we expect when we get them home to be of every different size, every different color, every different style, fit us perfectly, excite the admiration of everyone who sees us, and cost us as little as possible so that we can have several of them. Now, I have never managed to find a department store that sold an item of clothing like that. Usually, when I took it home, it remained exactly the same way it was when I saw it in the store, barring accidents, of course. And if I found that it didn't become me, or that I didn't like the way it draped, or that the color clashed with the thing I bought it to go with, well, then I've made an error, and I suppose I could take it back and, if it hadn't been worn, and get my money back for it. But the intangible there, I'm well aware that I'm not going to be able to get from the store. I am not purchasing from them an instant beauty kit. I am not purchasing magic. I am not buying a charm to make me irresistibly attractive in whatever this item of clothing is. I am purchasing something that, at the time, looks as if it would be what I wanted for the purpose I have in mind. But with our public education system, the purpose in mind of many parents is not to buy the end result of an educated person. It's to buy a child that they can brag about because they get straight A's on the report card, and it makes them look good to tell everybody else how smart little Johnny or little Susie is. Or to buy a guarantee that little Johnny will make it through 12 years of public school, then on go on to university for a bachelor's degree, and then further to a master's degree, and then for a PhD, and become incredibly wealthy, though little Johnny can take care of them and make sure that their condo is in good shape when they retire to Florida. Some parents are purchasing the intangible of building their child's self-esteem, making him feel good about himself because he goes to school and he gets good grades and everybody likes him and the teachers think he's wonderful. Some parents are purchasing from that same school system the intangible of, well, my child has difficulty learning, so you all are supposed to be experts, so I expect you to cure and fix every one of these difficulties and make my child the equal of the class valedictorian who lives down the street with absolutely no assistance from me, and no matter how badly off my child's learning abilities are. That's that, you know, magic charm on the dress that makes you look good no matter what. Our understanding of the value of education, ladies and gentlemen, is woefully, woefully vague. And that vagueness is what makes our public schools the mess they are. When you send your child to school, what value do you expect to receive from the tax money you pay that pays his teachers, the principals, the custodian, maintains the building, drives the school bus, fills it with gasoline, repairs it if it's damaged, purchases textbooks, school supplies, after-school activities, extracurricular resources such as band and art and so on and so forth? What is it? What value do you expect your child to receive from this? Are you purchasing a ticket to an amusement park so that the child has fun every day for 7.5 hours while you either go to work or stay at home with your feet propped up because you're exhausted from having gotten them all the way to 6 years old, still alive? What is it that you're purchasing? I know a lot of parents who are purchasing amusement park tickets, or at least it appears that way, because if their child is not having fun, they're not getting any value for their money. It's supposed to be fun to learn. Well, it is. Learning is a great deal of fun if you're actually doing it. But there's no guarantee that everything you're expected to learn is going to come easily or be as much fun as a video game or as hilarious as being tickled on the soles of your feet. Yet many parents firmly believe that their children should receive the value of a trip to Busch Gardens every day, Monday through Friday, from 7:30 until 2:30 in the afternoon. There are other parents who are purchasing with their tax money and their incredible effort in getting little Johnny and little Susie up, dressed, fed, and out the door, or at least up and dressed. Schools feed them now. The value that they are expecting to receive is having the school take over the parenting duties that they are too tired or too indifferent or too confused to assume themselves. They're purchasing, in effect, surrogate parents, a whole raft of them. Every teacher, every principal, the school nurse, the guidance counselor, the special education director, and all the other people who work there, they are buying them as surrogate parents. They're expected to give the child ethics, morality, self-esteem, self-confidence, belief in him or herself, knowledge, expertise, skills, and in some cases, even toilet training and the ability to behave in socially appropriate ways when in public. So that's what they're buying. That's the value that they're forking over their tax money for. And then there are the ones who are forking over their tax money because they are buying for their children instruction in the basic academic skills that their child will need in order to continue learning after school is finished. And they expect that solid foundation of academic skills to be durable enough to last that child his or her entire life as a foundation, as a platform from which that child can climb to whatever heights he or she is capable of reaching. That's the value they're expecting. There are many more different kinds of value, depending on the parent, depending on the child, the circumstances, the demographics, and all the other happy little fodder for the liars, damn liars, and statisticians that run our public schools. But in essence, we've got the same situation. We've got the parents walking into that department store of education and purchasing the one-size-fits-all outfit that will make their child brilliant, popular, happy, smart, well-educated, successful as an adult, and well-behaved under all circumstances. I would really, really, really like to see a department store like that. I truly would. I've always wanted to live in a world where magic is real, and that kind of department store would fit in very, very well. Walk in the door, and there you have it. Everything you ever wanted, everything that will make you absolutely wonderfully important as you are being told you are, is right there in front of you, and there's not a darn thing you have to do except sit there and absorb it all. Golly, wouldn't it be wonderful? Yeah, it would, but you can't have it. The value in an education does not come from what your mommy and daddy think they are buying. The value in your child's education doesn't come from, well, the school's supposed to teach him how to do all this stuff. That's what I send him there for. No. The value of an education is in how well it gives your child the opportunity to learn. Learning. A very odd word to many people. To some people, learning means having knowledge. To others, it means being able to repeat something that you have heard several times or only once, verbatim, so that you can say you have learned it. For many of our public school children, to learn something means that somebody mentioned it last year in math class, and I remember hearing the term, but I don't really need to know what it means. That is the average public school student's definition of learning. That's another one we need to really define. To learn something means to acquire the knowledge of it and retain it in your memory. Pretty straightforward. That's what learning means. If I have learned how to bake a cake, that means that I understand that it's got to have flour and eggs and sugar and salt and shortening, and it has to be whipped and it has to be placed in a baking pan and put in an oven before I can eat it. I have put in my memory the skills, the steps, and the processes of baking a cake. But there are a remarkable number of parents and students out there who don't seem to understand that's what learning means. To them, learning is bringing home a very pretty report card with lots of A's on it, and the teacher writing a little note saying, "Oh, Susie is such a sweet child, I just want to hug her to death." Or learning is doing well enough in class so that you don't turn people off by being a too smart nerd or be the butt of a bully by being a stupid jerk. And hopefully make lots and lots of friends and be a star on the football team, the basketball team, the volleyball team, the tiddlywinks team, whatever team it is your mother and daddy think you ought to be on. My friend California Living says, how true is the knowledge you get from a public school when the liberals are changing the facts of history? And that's quite true. The knowledge that you're getting from public schools these days may definitely be suspect, because quite often it's slanted in the direction of a specific political agenda. But if you are never given the knowledge of how to read this stuff and think about it, you have no hope of extending your search for learning outside of predigested garbage presented to you in a classroom. I am less afraid of the indoctrination of liberal textbooks than I am of the de-emphasis on being able to read at all. And don't kid yourselves, folks. It is being de-emphasized. Very subtly and very clearly. The number of classes in high school where students no longer actually have to read Shakespeare's plays, they just watch the Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor version of Taming of the Shrew, or Mel Gibson's Hamlet. And he actually did a fairly good job in it, and at least they had actual Shakespearean dialogue. And it's quite true, seeing Shakespeare perform makes it live more vividly than just reading. But when you start to de-emphasize the ability to read, comprehend, and think about what you have read, you get the world of Fahrenheit 451. If you have not read it or seen the movie with Oscar Werner and Julie Christie, made in the 1960s, I believe, you should. Because in that world, everything is visual. Everyone has a huge, giant flat screen in their living room, and their day is spent watching what is going on throughout their community. Reading is illegal, books are illegal, and the main character, played by Oscar Werner, is a fireman whose job it is not to put out fires, but to burn books wherever he finds them. That value that California Living has just mentioned, upper education filled with nonsense to charge you the student more money per credit to reach a degree, and yes, that's pretty much it. Because what matters is not the knowledge that you acquire in college education. That's not the value that it is perceived to be. Its value is a piece of paper that supposedly will allow you to collect more money on the job. If you have that piece of paper saying that you managed to endure elementary basket weaving and the Alinsky path as your main courses, you should be able to get a job 10 minutes after you graduate paying you $75,000 to $100,000 a year. At least that's what most college students expect. So the value of that education is quite tangible, at least in most people's minds. Its value is in how much it stands for in salary. Unfortunately, in many cases, the outgoing graduate with his Bachelor of Arts degree is finding himself a job at McDonald's because his or her major in women's studies or Middle Eastern philosophy is really not very useful in a brokerage firm, a law office, or a hospital. It comes back to, what is the value of your education? Is it a dollar sign for your potential earnings? Is it an intangible that you're putting a dollar sign on that somehow is going to make you a more attractive or popular or successful individual as a human being? Is the value a surrogate parenting because for whatever reasons your mom and dad just really don't want to take the time to parent themselves? What is the value of education to most of the people in this country? Does it have a value at all? Or is it just something you're supposed to do because without it, you can't have something else? Why do we send our children to school? What is it that we are buying when we send them there? Are we buying report cards that look pretty sitting on the mantelpiece? And that back up the bumper that says, proud to have an honor student at Gazornan Platts Middle School? Are we buying the child's self-esteem in the sense that the teachers are all going to tell little Johnny he's wonderful, even though he can't manage to remember that cat has three letters and he bites people when he's upset. Believe me, that was my grandson. So I'm not just talking, you know, other parents. What is it that we're buying? What value do we expect from education? What value do you want that public school to give you? We all know what we don't want. As California Living says, union protection, pedophile teachers, the rubber room, the school can't fire the teacher. We all know what we don't want. It's easy to say, I don't want that one, and I don't want that one, and I don't want that one, and I don't want that one, when you're standing at the candy counter and looking all at the various goodies in front of you. I could point out about six of them I don't want right off the bat. But what do we want? What is it that we, as libertarians, Republicans, conservatives, free market people, Tea Party people, people who don't buy into the utopian Marxist ideal of our current administration, what is it that we want from our educational system? Before we can go out there and totally change it and revamp it and clean it up, we have got to have a vision of what we want it to be. Our founding fathers had a vision of what they wanted this nation to be. They were not unanimous about it. The amount of almost fistfights that occurred during the Constitutional Convention, if the reporters had been in there with hidden microphones, would appall all of us. Those delegates were bickering and arguing and contentiously fighting each other throughout the entire process. But they did manage to hammer out a framework called the Constitution of the United States. And in spite of idiots like our current president, it's worked pretty doggone well up until now, and I believe that it will continue to do so when the love affair with the historic first black president is over with. We need a roadmap, ladies and gentlemen. We need an architectural diagram. We need a menu. What are the things that we want from our public schools? What do we expect for the tax money, the value of the dollars we put into it? What do you want? Each and every one of you out there. I can tell you what I want. I want my grandsons to have the opportunity to learn the academic skills and information they need in order to continue learning until they die. That means I want them taught how to read and comprehend what they read. I want them to be taught mathematics, arithmetic, and higher math. I want them to be taught history, both of the United States as a nation and of the world. I want them to be taught geography. I want them to be taught science. I want them to be given the chance to learn anything and everything that is set in front of them. And if they have trouble learning, I want the school to tell me or their parents so that we can do something at home to help build their skills. That's what I want from a school. What is it that you want? Do you want football, baseball, volleyball, track, music, art, drama? What do you want from your public school? Do you want classrooms with 30 people or classrooms with 10 people? Do you want collaborative classes or classes that are specifically designed for students with learning disabilities? and classes for those who do not have them. Separated. What is it that you want? Because right now, we're spending a great deal of time discussing what we don't want. We know, right off the bat, we certainly don't want Common Core. Because Common Core not only dumbs down the American population, it puts the federal fingers directly on the pulse, literally the pulse, of your child's wrist. I would not want my grandchildren wired to their desks so their physical reactions to everything during the day can be telemetered to a central computer and their fate decided on whether or not they were sufficiently within the normal range of reaction to be allowed to continue to the next grade. What is it that you do want? My friend Rod says, teach the real things that count. History, addition, subtraction, how to read English. I agree. Get rid of the idea that somehow or other, if your parents came from somewhere else, you should have classes taught in whatever language they spoke. And start paying attention to the fact that if you are coming here to live for the rest of your life, it would help if you learned the dominant language of the nation. The one all of our signs are written in. Our newspapers. Our maps. Rod says, and the Constitution. Exactly. Political science. Or government, as they call it, under the social studies banner. What is the structure of our government so that my grandsons understand why they're supposed to vote? Not just because mommy does, or Johnny down the street does, or somebody told them if they went to vote, they'd get a ride on a bus to get to the polling place. And the laws. And teach them also, by example, and by the structure of classrooms, that when you are in a classroom, your behavior is supposed to be that of someone who actually listens and pays attention. But actually, I don't think I need the school to teach my kids that. That's, or my grandchildren. It's not the school's job to teach my children when they walk in the door that they're supposed to sit still and talk and listen to the teacher and not discuss their latest video game or what they're wearing to the dance or who's sleeping with whom and who kissed who in the back hallway. They can do that in the cafeteria. They will anyway, or in the hallways. But once they're in a classroom, I would like to bring back, instead of the child-centered classroom, which means the kid runs the place, the child-centered classroom in which every child in it understands that his fellow students are there to learn, and behaving like an idiot steals their opportunity from them. And I don't care if you don't care, just shut up and let the people who want to learn do so. That's something that has to be done at home. I do want order in classrooms. Not the rigid kind of order that means you leap to your feet, click your heels, salute, and say, yes, mein Herr. But the kind of order that means you raise your hand if you have a question or you want to interject something. Or you need to use the restroom. Or you don't understand something. And the teacher has the opportunity, as well as the duty, to say, I'm sorry you don't understand. Tell you what, stay after class for a few minutes and I'll see if I can explain it to you. So that the entire class isn't held still while someone asks the same question six times and doesn't listen to one of the answers. And believe me, I've been in classrooms like that. My friend Rod says that when he was taught in the good old days, as was I, education meant learning things to get prepared for a job. And that is one of its tangible values. Obviously, if you're going to earn a living in a way that allows you to purchase the necessities and some of the necessary luxuries of life, you have to have some sort of academic skills. There are very few people who are able to command a decent living wage who can neither read, write, nor speak English. and you can't add 5 plus 2 and come up with 7 at least twice in a row. And who understand that you don't pour bleach and ammonia together unless you want to kill everybody in the building. We have got to determine, ladies and gentlemen, students and teachers all, what it is that we do want from our public schools. So that when we go to our school board meetings, our PTA meetings, our confabulations of Tea Party and concerned groups against Common Core, or whatever way we gather together to express ourselves, we need to have in mind what it is we want from school. My friend Rod just mentioned something that our public schools now do not understand. And they should, because it has not changed since he and I were in school. Learning with grades showed you were able to learn. And the employees were looking for teachable people. Employers are still looking for teachable people, ladies and gentlemen, especially in this rapidly developing technological world. Grades were supposed to measure your mastery of specific skills or understanding of specific processes. That is what they are for. They are not supposed to measure how much the teacher likes you, how many times you emptied the wastebasket, cleaned blackboards, or tidied up the back book corner. They are supposed to tell your parents, the teachers you will be going to in your next grade, your principal, your guidance counselor, and future employers, what it is you have mastered and are capable of doing, as well as whether or not you are teachable. It used to be, long ago, even before my time, when my grandparents were in school, that you could make a decent living and raise a family and be an honored member of society with only a 5th, 6th, or 7th grade education. If you went through the local country school as far as 8th grade, your reading ability, your mathematical ability, your understanding of American history, your familiarity with science, as much as was known at the time, was the equivalent of what is now considered a sophomore in college, especially reading. You try to get any 8th grader in these days to actually sit down and read Les Miserables, for example, in English, and have them get past the first paragraph without having to raise their hand and say, this is too hard, I can't do it, which they will do. I go through agonies with some of the kids that I have in my little jail. When I assign them a story that's 5 pages long, you would think that I had hauled them off the benches of the galleys, tied them up in the forepeak, and lashed them half to death with a cat of nine tails. I am inflicting severe and unusual punishment on them because I'm making them read 5 whole pages worth of a story. And there aren't even illustrations on every page. If we would stop trying to make schools amusement parks, our kids might discover that it actually is fun to learn things. Instead of, if it isn't fun, I don't have to learn things, which is the current philosophy. School is the job, the work, the labor of childhood in our culture nowadays. That didn't used to be the case. 200 years ago, child labor was perfectly legal. And not just on the family farm. Children were expected to add to the family exchequer whether they went to school or not. And sometimes the family was too poor to be able to afford decent clothing, so the child couldn't go to school and was put to work as soon as he was 6 or 7 years old, especially in the big cities, as a newsboy or running errands or, you know, helping out the local gang or, you know, going to the store for mom or, you know, picking pockets or whatever other kind of job he had a skill for, because he was expected to work. Everybody did. The only people who didn't work are those who were incredibly wealthy and generally had servants to do the manual labor for them. And their work consisted of attending committee meetings, parties, intermingling with each other, making business deals, building railroads, steel mills, opening up the West, sailing ships to China to bring back goods, opening trade routes. They had a very different kind of work. But everybody understood that in this world, nothing is free. They understood that everything that you want, you have got to put forth some effort to get, even if it's only as much effort as reaching for the teapot to pour out at the Ladies' Aid Society, if you want them to agree with your proposition to recarpet the church. You had to put forth an effort to get anything. The candy bar from the corner store, if you swept out Mr. Fazuzzi Watts' store for 7 days running, he might reward you with, maybe a handful of penny candy, because you weren't really old enough to be paid, but this way you weren't trying to raid mummy's very thin purse for a nickel to buy that penny candy. You were earning it. My friend Rod says he has a brother-in-law who's 20 years younger than he is and can't read, but he works well with his hands so he can get work. And that's quite true. Before the advent of so much technology that does most of the manual labor for us, good working hands were absolutely necessary. There was no stigma in working as a domestic servant. As a matter of fact, many young girls went into service in this country and in Europe as a way to better themselves. They were fed and clothed, they learned skills, and when they were old enough to leave service, if they were lucky, they had enough put by that they could have their own little place to live, or they married someone else who was in service and found a place together, or both of them were able to leave domestic service and work in a shop or even have their own little farm. Work was noble. Everybody was expected to do it. If you read classics from the 19th century, such as for young people like Little Women or the Anne of Green Gables books, or any of the books that our parents and grandparents read for entertainment, the underlying theme in all of them, no matter what they were about, no matter what the characters had happened to them or what the story was about, everybody worked at something. Because without work, you didn't get anything. That is not the philosophy in our public schools, ladies and gentlemen. So that's something I do want. That's something I do want in our public schools. The expectation of a reasonable work ethic. Expectation of a reasonable work ethic, not just for the students either. I would really like not to have to close my ISS classroom every Friday and fill in for all of the teachers who have the Friday flu. Because we can't get enough substitutes, even on a good day, and on Friday you might as well forget it. It seems we already have a 4-day work week without legislation to make it de rigueur and the law of the land. I know something else that I want from public schools. I want kids to have memory work practice. I would like to see what was done when I was in school. Every week, and it depended on the teacher, but usually it was on Friday, in English class or science class or one of the classes somewhere, everybody would have to recite something. And if it was a large class, it was set up so that you recited maybe twice a month or even once a month, but you stood up and recited something that you had memorized. And this was not to prove that we could parrot things off like a minor bird. It was to show that we knew how to make ourselves remember something. That training, that practice, that was essential. That was the way we learned how to learn. Because there are some things in our lives that we have to remember, not just be vaguely familiar with having heard them before. Not everybody has an eidetic memory. An eidetic memory is the memory that recalls everything that you have heard, seen, or read and can pull it out to the forefront of your mind on demand. I certainly do not have one. I have never known anyone who did. My husband did know a young woman in college who had that kind of memory. She was even tested at Duke University for her abilities. But she had about as much common sense as a dirty potato. She could remember everything. She could remember on what page number a particular sentence of a philosophy text was. But if you asked her to explain it or put it in context with other philosophical thought of the same time, she'd stare at you like a fish waiting for its supper and just going, She remembered it, but she didn't understand it. Well, the current public school philosophy is that, oh, if we just love them enough, they'll understand it through osmosis and they'll feel their way to the right answer and they won't have to actually remember anything. Again, ladies and gentlemen, our all-wise, all-important government and the experts it hires to reform our educational system, none of whom actually teach anybody anything, have found a way to take the understanding that learning can't be all memorization and carry it to reductio ad absurdum again. They've taken it so far out of the context of common sense that it's probably already at Andromeda and frightening the citizens of that particular star system. We have to have a public school that addresses the necessary skills involved in learning. Memorization is necessary because there are some things you have to memorize. For example, if you call the same number every day in your job, you're supposed to remember it. Nowadays, of course, you don't have to because it's programmed into your PDF, your BlackBerry, your cell phone, your computer, whatever. You just poke a button and bang, you're connected. But you still have to remember the person's name that's written next to that thing, or you have to remember which number it is on your speed dial. Memory is important. We have to train our children to understand that. But also understanding what is behind or around or connected to what we have memorized is important as well. It does me no good whatsoever to be able to recite the preamble to the Constitution if I have no clue what the words mean. I remember a student we had in our tutoring center who could read perfectly. She read every word exactly correctly, but she had absolutely, literally no idea what it was she was reading. This child was disabled intellectually. I guess that's a politically correct term these days. But she could read everything. Oh, my friend Doc says, but teacher, I just learned it for the test. Oh my God, yes. We've got those too. That is memorization without understanding. And my sister had a boyfriend who did that. He got A's in his criminal justice course in college. And he was quite frank about the fact that he memorized it all, short-term memory, spilled it on the test, and forget he ever saw it before. I hope and pray, dear God, that that man is not a cop anywhere in the state of Virginia. Or anywhere else, for that matter. the number of kids that I see who are doing that. But we are done with fractions, Ms. Rowland. We learned that last year. I don't need to remember that anymore. It's a litany, ladies and gentlemen. I hear it all the time. I want that put back in our public schools. The understanding that learning something means not only remembering it, as in memorization, but understanding it and being able to relate it to other parts of what you know or are learning. My friend Sparky says that today's schools are not about teaching, but training. Do what you're told, we'll give you stuff. That's very much the case. Reminds me of the story I told last time about the Soviet schools, where the children were all told to close their eyes and pray to God for candy, and after a few minutes told to open them, and of course there was no candy. And they did this a couple of times, and there still was no candy. And then they were told to close their eyes and pray to the state for candy, and lo and behold, when they opened them, there was candy right on their desk. Pavlovian training. That's behavioral psychology, ladies and gentlemen. I cannot stand the behaviorists. They give me a stomachache. But it works. If you set up, that kind of thinking pattern, that kind of Pavlovian action response with children, you're going to get that kind of inability to actually make sense of anything they have heard. You are setting up basically a cage full of proto-humans who will respond correctly so long as you promise them something that they want. And as soon as you have them salivating, you can withhold the thing that they want until they have completed the rest of the tricks required. Then you can give them their tidbit. How many of you remember the movie Young Frankenstein? I hope many of you do, because it's a classic comedy. And when Gene Wilder has Peter Boyle, the monster, up on stage in the local theater, and he's showing him that he's nothing to be afraid of, and he can dance and sing, and they do Putting on the Ritz together. And but even before that, Peter Boyle says, stand on one leg, this, that, and the other. And every time he does it, of course, Gene Wilder, surreptitiously, but obviously pops a little treat in his mouth. In effect, that scene is a perfect metaphor for public education as progressives see it. That is exactly what public education in the progressive utopia should look like. Frankenstein's monster standing on the stage in a tuxedo with the footlights bathing him in their glorious light, standing on one leg and accepting a treat when he does it correctly. Yeah. My friend Linda mentions, and I hope you feel better soon, Linda. I worry about you. You go see the doctor. I don't like the idea of you having the flu. But anyway, enough digression for a moment. The Common Core crowd are saying that the kids don't have to have the correct answer so long as they can explain the answer that they gave. Okay. 2 plus 2 is 6. That's not correct. Yes, but it could be, because if you had 2 rabbits, female rabbits, and 2 male rabbits, and you left them alone long enough, the female rabbits would each have a baby and you'd have 6 rabbits. So 2 plus 2 makes 6. Don't you think I should get an A in math? I think so. And under those rules, I would. That's an explanation, right? I can give an explanation about just about anything, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very good at explaining things, Lucy. Now, whether or not my explanation makes any sense is irrelevant. So long as I explain it in a way that, oh, I guess you could say, sings praise to the president or fits in with the Alinsky Code or somehow or other promotes Marxist utopia, so long as my explanation fits into one of those lovely little channels, then I am correct. Because it doesn't really matter if I know that 2 plus 2 actually does equal 4, so long as I am a good cog in the progressive wheel and I can make an explanation that sounds good enough to get me reelected to Congress. We have the explainer in chief right now. It's amazing. I really didn't think that Harvard taught the way that Common Core wants to teach when he was there, but then again, they might have. Maybe that's where they started it. So long as I can explain the answer I have, it's okay if it's not correct. Because what matters is how I feel about it. Oh my God. I really, really, really would like to see, it would be pathetic, but it would be hilarious, some aeronautical engineer who designs an aircraft so that the tail portion, the empennage portion, after 100,000 hours of flight, falls off so that you have to replace it to keep it safe, and doesn't put that in the specs. I really, really would like to have to see that aeronautical engineer explaining that he did it that way because he felt people needed to learn a lesson about proper maintenance of aircraft. And that would not get him kicked out of his profession, sued by everybody who lost their lives when the empennage section fell off the damn plane, and probably imprisoned for incompetence. But he can explain it. So it must be right. And another thing I don't want in public schools. Well, so far we've heard what I want. What about what you want? What do you want? I've heard from Rod. He wants kids to learn about history and math and how our government works. My friend Linda, I think, would like to have children have the opportunity to exercise their brains so that it'll become flaccid and gel-like through disuse. In other words, being challenged. Instead of, oh, it's okay if you can't figure out that chemical symbol for oxygen is the big letter O. You can just say oxy and we'll know what you mean. What do you think your school should do? How much do you want them to do for your child? That's another one. Another one of those values that we think we're getting from public school, or at least many parents do. They seem to think that they're purchasing a whole cadre of educators to do things for little Johnny and little Susie, to read their lessons for them because reading is hard for Johnny and Susie, to set up the classroom so that Johnny or Susie has their own private corner because they're so easily distracted, that they're supposed to walk Johnny and Susie out onto the playground. Somebody should be there to do that because they get tired of sitting still. And if they don't go outside and walk, they'll disrupt the class. So that means you will have to have at least three aides in there so that the Johnny and Susie can be walked and the third aide can still be in there to help the teacher with Freddie and Tommy, who will fight if they're in the same room together. How much do you want the schools to do for your kids? It's a question I think most parents don't ask themselves. What is it you want them to do for your children? My friend Yo says she'd get rid of that crap, and I'm with her, so would I. Having been there, done that, and not enjoyed it a great deal, I heartily agree. I would get rid of it too. And it isn't because I don't have compassion for those who have difficulties or disabilities. I do. But I do not have compassion for those who tell those children that the entire world is going to bow down and worship them because they have problems. And I have seen it happen. I have absolutely no compassion whatsoever for the fools who tell these kids that the world is going to be made perfect for them, that everybody loves them. Everybody is going to understand their problems and bend over backwards to accommodate to them. Because that is what is happening. Something I would like to see in our public schools is a little honesty. And you can be honest and diplomatic at the same time. You don't have to be blunt and unkind. You can be honest. As my husband's parents were with him. and his teachers as well. Look, kid, you've got something called dyslexia going on. That means it's going to be twice as hard for you to learn how to read as it is for everybody else. You can do it, but you're going to have to work your little tail parts off. It's not going to be easy. But I believe in you, and I believe that you'll want to learn this badly enough that you'll put forth the very best effort you have to do it. And it worked. He did. Not because somebody told him the world would read everything to him. And to the day he died, he preferred audiobooks, because although he could read, it took him longer and it was a little more difficult than it is for me. So he found ways to enjoy reading for pleasure that didn't require as much effort and still gave him what he needed. But he could read, and quite well, as a matter of fact, because he wanted to. And my friend Doc says, you are all winners. That's the other thing I don't want in there. What I'd rather have our public schools say is, there are winners and there are losers. It's up to you to try to be a winner and to learn how to be a good winner. But if you can't win, you also have to learn how to be a good loser. That's the way we were taught. We weren't taught that everybody got a trophy, that everybody won the game. We were taught something called good sportsmanship, real good sportsmanship. Not the fake tear-making crap of, oh, all the little boys in the lot put the little autistic child up and threw the ball at him so he could hit it and then refused to pick it up and gave him an end and he felt so good. I'm sure he did. I'm sure he did. But I also know that I probably would have had him do something that I knew he could do, that he honestly could get praise for, that was hard for him, but that he tried hard at and mastered. Because that taught him, that gave him accomplishment, and accomplishment is what gives each of us self-esteem. It cannot be handed to us with a pretty blue ribbon attached on a piece of paper or on a plate. The only way we will have real self-esteem and self-confidence is if we achieve something that we've worked hard at. It doesn't matter what that thing is, whether it's climbing Mount Everest or finding the cure for cancer or learning how to throw a ball so that it doesn't hit somebody in the head behind you. I want that back in school. I want the achievements of everybody to be recognized for what they are, not artificially inflated or pretend given. Well, some of you are probably disappointed that I actually have got my voice back now, since I've basically been babbling away now for a little over an hour. But I can tell you it feels good to be able to talk. I've often been told that if I weren't able to talk, I'd probably just go off into a corner, wither up, and die. And the folks who tell me that are probably quite wise. I'm guessing I probably would, mainly because I was taught growing up that one of the greatest gifts we've ever been given is the ability to communicate. The ability to share our thoughts and our feelings with one another. And by that, eventually make our little corner of the world a better place. I do not have the skills of a great surgeon, ladies and gentlemen. I couldn't possibly drive a race car if my life depended upon it without probably plowing into a wall and ending my life very quickly. I have absolutely no mechanical ability. I know where you put the nozzle to put gasoline in the car. I can release the little catch that holds the hood down, and when I look in there, I could probably find out where the oil goes, but that's about it. But I do have other skills, And being able to speak coherently and articulately is one of them. And I was taught that each of us is given our talents, our skills, our abilities, so that we may use them for the good of ourselves, our loved ones, and our fellow human beings, and the other beings with whom we share the planet. I also was taught sportsmanship and how to be a good winner and a good loser. And I was taught that I couldn't be a winner at everything. At home, when my dad played cards with me and my sisters, he didn't let us win. If we did beat him, we really achieved something. We had done something great. We had used a skill that he had taught us to even get better at whatever it was than he was. Talk about raising your self-esteem. I've always liked being a winner, too, as my friend Rod says. I enjoy winning. I don't know anybody who doesn't. I don't enjoy losing. It's not exactly pleasant. But I was also taught that you don't have to enjoy losing, but you do have to remember, win or lose, to enjoy the game. If you cannot enjoy the game, do not play. Because there will always be times when you win and times when you lose. So if you do not enjoy the game for the game's sake, find a different game. And in a way, that's what our public schools are not teaching, ladies and gentlemen. They say they are, only what they're doing is, quote-unquote, leveling the playing field. They're making the game no longer exist so that everybody can win it. They're completely changing all of the rules and all of the goals of the game so that nobody knows exactly what they're playing, but we all feel really good about ourselves while we do it. I would like that removed from our public educational philosophy. And it's true, as Doc says, that win at all costs is often taught in certain arenas of society. Famous quote of Vince Lombardi, legendary coach of the Green Bay Packers. Winning isn't the best thing, it's the only thing. The idea that you must win or die has been part of most coaches' plan in team sports ever since there have been team sports. I'm sure that the Cro-Magnon, as he was bashing a stone between himself and his fellow primitive from the next village, probably bashed the primitive from the next village pretty hard to get the stone away from him, too. If you've ever watched the real game of lacrosse, as invented by the Northern Plains Indians, you'll know exactly what I mean. It was warrior training, as most games were. That's how they originated. That was the purpose of them. But school is not supposed to be an amusement park or a game where the rules change according to who you are, what your disability is, whether or not the teacher likes you, how much influence your parents have, whether or not you're related to the school board superintendent or whatever. That's not what it's supposed to be. It was proposed to have public schools, free public education, as a great leveler, not in the way of the level playing field where we were all alike, as a misconstrued synonym for equal, but a way for everybody to have an equal start, a way for everybody to have that opportunity to fly as high and far as their wings would take them. That's what it was supposed to be. That was the rule of the game. If you enjoyed learning, it was fun. Perhaps it wasn't a riot. Maybe you didn't get to play with your iPad or go outside for recess and, you know, have organized sports and school trips and everything else. But there were fun things, usually community-led. The schools were very important in the communities of the 19th century. They were the social focus. The kids gave recitals, stood up and said pieces, gave concerts, and all the parents and the aunts and uncles and neighbors and everybody came because there really wasn't a whole heck of a lot of other entertainment available. And everybody wanted to be proud of little Susie or little Johnny when they stood up and recited a poem or sang in a chorus or put on a little play. We don't see our schools, most of us, that way anymore. There are still places where that does happen. It happens in High County. But we're a rural county. And even though the internet and technology have opened the broader world to us, people still do turn out for the school plays and the school concerts and the open house nights to introduce the kids to their new home away from home 5 days a week every August. I would like to see that sense of community, that the school belongs to everyone in the community. I would like to see that come back in my ideal public education system. Not as a means of penalizing those who stand out from the crowd or who might be a little different or excluding people, but simply because in the school, everybody has a chance to put the best of themselves towards the future. Because that's what our children are. We hope that they will achieve more than we have. Otherwise, why bother to have them? They don't make good pets, trust me. They're way too expensive. There must be a reason that we decide to marry and produce offspring. And mostly that reason, I think, is because we want the future to carry something of us. We want to leave an imprint so that our children can carry into a future we will not see something of ourselves. And in order to do that, we need to have them become educated persons. Whatever our description or mental image of an educated person is, we need our kids to be that, so that the mark of us they take forward will be a good one, a respected one, a positive one, and may make the future better for them and their descendants. Until we all stop pointing fingers at what we don't want and start trying to put together what we do want and lose the rose-colored glasses that every little Johnny and every little Susie is capable of a PhD and is Albert Einstein brilliant and accept the fact that no, not everybody is. And that's okay. We are not going to get the kind of public education system that it was intended for us to have by our founders. They knew, as modern Americans apparently don't, that alike and equal do not mean the same thing, and that nothing has value if it cannot be used and you have not worked for it. They understood human nature, that no matter how hard you try, you cannot redesign the human spirit to fit into a nice, neat little box and do exactly what you tell it 24/7, 365 days per year until it dies. They were very wise men and very experienced men. They had fought a war against the most powerful nation in the Western world, and they had won against all odds. And they were damned if they were going to let anybody come in and start telling them what to do after they'd sacrificed so much. So they managed, amidst all the quarrels and the arguments and the disagreements and the raised canes and the shouting and the insults and the potential calling out into a duel, they managed to find compromises to put this country together and make it the most powerful and wealthiest land in the history of mankind. Because, ladies and gentlemen, they were educated persons. Every single one of them. Not because they all went to Harvard or William and Mary, but because every single one of them knew how and wanted to learn more tomorrow than they knew today. and they understood that if this nation, as it was constituted, were to prosper, every citizen should have that equal opportunity to do as they did, to become educated persons. Because it is only educated persons who can and will use their franchise to elect people to represent them, whose plans, ideals, visions, and agendas match with the American spirit and the American philosophy that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If our public schools can get those ideas firmly planted in the minds and souls of our children, this nation will endure and prosper and lead the way to greater freedom for other nations in this world of ours. But only if we understand what it is we want an education to be. Do we want it to be a piece of paper that guarantees you X dollars when you show it to someone? Or do we want it to be what makes an educated person who understands individual liberty and individual responsibility, and who believes that if it doesn't break my leg or pick my pocket, you can do anything you doggone well please, so long as you understand that you will take the consequences for your own actions? If we can remember those things, ladies and gentlemen, and codify and put together what we want from public education, we are armed with truth. We are not just going and complaining and shouting and whining and screaming and blaming people. That does very little good. We have to have something in mind that we can do. What do we want to make out of this failed system? Just screaming about it and arguing about it and complaining about it is not going to fix it. I could stand in front of my broken washing machine and call it every name in the book and swear and curse every designer who put it together and all the bolts that made it, but it's not going to make the damn washing machine work. Something inside it isn't working and I've got to fix it. And that's the case with our educational system. It will not happen if all we do is stand and scream at the washing machine. Go to your school board meetings, ladies and gentlemen. Join the PTA, whether you've got kids in school or not. Look at the textbooks that are being ordered. What are they saying? Find out what goes on in the classrooms. Volunteer. If you're able, take a substitute job so you see what happens in the classrooms. So you see how the children in your community behave to one another, towards their teachers. How do the teachers behave to the kids? Find out what's going on. Watch, pay attention, and put together in your mind and in your heart the value you expect from public education. And when you go to those school board meetings and those PTA meetings, have a list of things you want to see put there. Not just things you want to get rid of. Positive things, things that we should do this. And if somebody objects, have enough armor with you and enough facts with you to counter or at least meet their objections with courtesy and clarity. Because it is all, those are part of the things that we would like to have. My friend Doc says the schools will become armed camps. Not sure you can even get in a school if you don't have a student there. That's true if you're just visiting. But if you have the ability to sign up as a substitute, basically, I don't know what each state is, but pretty much they do a background check and make sure you're not a child molester or a felon or something like that. And most schools I know would love to have a larger list of substitute teachers. That's the best way I know to find out what goes on in classrooms. Again, ladies and gentlemen, I believe that every single one of us is this nation. I believe that every single one of us is both a student and a teacher our lives long. And I believe that every single one of us has value. Because we each have that human spirit, that soul, that peace of the Almighty within us that says, I believe that I have the right to search for happiness in my own way. And I believe that you have that same right. And I believe that both of us have the responsibility of the consequences of our search. If we can deal with one another in this way, if we can present what we do want from school, then we won't be seen as just complaining old fuddy-duddies who don't know what's good for the children of today. We will be seen as those who have gained experience, have discovered what works and are seeing what doesn't, and have a plan to make things work better. I'm hoping everyone will join me next week at the same time, 6 p.m. on Blog Talk Radio, every Thursday night for Patriot Education. There'll be a list of all of our radio shows brought to you by www.patriotfamilies, that's patriotfamilies.com. A group of people who truly believe that we are the nation and who do their very, very best to be the pebble that starts the avalanche. To all of you in the chat room, Linda, Doc, Rod, Bill, Yolanda, who had to leave because she was tired, and Rod, and the folks out there listening, thank you so much for joining me this evening. Thank you for your support, your kindness, your compassion, and your love. Your love of country, your love of truth, and love of what is right, as well as the love you've shown me throughout our association. As always, all my love to my biggest fan. May you have a lovely evening, ladies and gentlemen. Ms. Linda, you take good care of yourself and you see that doctor, okay? Unless you feel better really quickly. Everybody out there listening in tonight, I believe in you too. Be the very best student and the very best teacher that is in you to be. And this nation of ours can't go far wrong. Good night, folks, and God bless.
Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education. And on Friday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Exposed But Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.